This is Dan Dix here, reporting for Press for Truth. Viewers of this channel are likely already well aware of the fact that various governments will use false flag attacks in order to manipulate and control their own population, but also to pin the blame on their political enemy. But how many of you are aware of the coming cyber warfare false flag attack that seeks to change the internet as we know it today and also pin the blame on a political enemy? Well, joining us on the line today is our good friend James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. He's going to help break all this down for us. So, James, thank you so much for joining us today on Press for Truth.
Thank you for having me back on, Dan. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Now, it seems to me, James, that right now, amongst the minds of the masses anyways, there seems to be a perception that the CIA is having an effect right now against ISIS, that they're winning the battle in Syria, that they're managing to push back. Of course, you and I both know that ISIS is a creation of the CIA. The two are one and the same. But for the general masses out there, they seem to be under the perception that the CIA is winning the battle against ISIS. So I'm wondering, do you think it seems like we're ripe and ready for a new boogeyman? And if so, how is cyber warfare going to play into this agenda?
Well, to be clear, the Islamic State, to the extent that it was ever really a functional state, does not appear to be such at this point. So it is now just a military cleanup operation, as it were, to get rid of ISIS from Syria / Western Iraq. And that, of course, will not defeat the never-ending scare that comes from these terror groups. Whether it is ISIS or another group that comes along to take its place, there will be some sort of boogeyman that will be put in front of the public's face and dangled there precisely for the effects that I think, as you alluded to, we all know, in order to keep the population in fear. And that is the old war on terror paradigm that we've been living through for the better part of a couple of decades now, and should be quite familiar by now. And of course, it is just a question of who is wearing the boogeyman mask at any given time. And right now, for whatever reason, Al-Qaeda is not wearing that mask. They're the good guys in Syria because they're fighting Assad, and ISIS are kind of the bad guys, but we don't want to fight them too hard, all of that. I mean, again, your viewers know about this, and there is the sense that at least the main part of the fighting is drawing to a close with regards to ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So the question is, well, where will the boogeyman mask land next? And I think what we may be experiencing shortly, but certainly will be experiencing in the coming years, is a changeover not just of the boogeyman from this CIA-funded and supported terror group to another, but a changeover of the paradigm. Obviously, in the pre-1990s, we'll say, the prevailing terror paradigm that we all have to be afraid of was the Soviet Union. It was the Cold War. When that collapsed, of course, we got all the end of history kind of talk and the clash of civilizations talk, and we were then introduced to the war on terror paradigm, obviously, most startlingly, on September 11th, 2001. And I think in order to move the conversation into a new paradigm, we're going to need a new catalyzing event, a new Pearl Harbor to refocus the population's attention on whatever new boogeyman comes along. And it's in that vein that I wrote my recent editorial about bracing for cyber 9/11, because cyber 9/11 is a meme, an idea that has been put out there pretty consistently, almost since 9/11 itself. I think it was 2003 that we had former head of the NSA, Mike McConnell, coming out and talking about how there is going to be the equivalent to the attack on the World Trade Center in the online sphere, and we need to get prepared for it. And ever since that point, there has been the constant bringing up of this idea of a cyber 9/11. And I think it is in the cards, and that is where I think we need to be looking for the next gigantic 9/11-style attack. Is unlikely, I think, to be a terror attack in that sense. At any rate, it's going to involve, even if it is a physical event, it will involve some element of cyber online operation to it as well, in order for them to bring us into the new paradigm, which I think will be the cyber terror paradigm.
Well, have they ever tried this before? Like, are there any examples that we can look to, you know, as things that, you know, that can be a warning sign for what's to come? Have they ever attempted this before, just on a smaller scale?
Well, actually, the most interesting part of the Cyber 9/11 meme is that the real Cyber 9/11 actually occurred on 9/11. And that relates to this company called P-TECH that was founded in Quincy, Massachusetts in 1994, and that developed a piece of enterprise architecture software called P-TECH. I've talked about that story before, and in fact, I have an essay on that in my forthcoming book that people should stay tuned for, because I think it's a particularly fascinating story. So I think there was a cyber element to 9/11 itself. It's just, of course, that could never be admitted, because, of course, that talks to the inside job nature of 9/11 and the fact that Cheney was likely running P-TECH in the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, injecting the fake blips onto the radar screens and all of that nonsense that was going on 9/11. But if we want to look at perfectly, openly admitted, completely talked about elements of the cyber warfare that's already taking place, we need look no further than Stuxnet, which is pretty much, I think, universally agreed to be the first major piece of cyber weaponry that was ever developed. And when it was first discovered, I believe in 2010, out in the wilds in the internet, it caused a lot of consternation. Here's this worm. We don't know where it came from or what exactly it's doing. Researchers were eventually able to piece together that this was a computer worm that was designed quite specifically to target the uranium processing facilities at the Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility in Iran. And surprise, surprise, it didn't take much digging from there to discover that this was a cyber weapon that was developed and is now openly admitted to have been developed jointly by the United States and Israel. So the first major piece of cyber weaponry was developed specifically by the U.S. and Israel to attack their enemy. And of course, it was disguised in a way that the actual provenance of that coming from U.S. and Israel was not openly admitted, at any rate. It wasn't exactly signed and sealed and delivered in the worm itself. But it is now openly admitted. And the interesting part of that story is that they launched this cyber attack on Iran, and somehow or other there was a problem with the code, and although it was supposed to stay contained and specifically attack that uranium enrichment facility at Natanz, it got onto the internet and kind of spread all over the world. Oops, oopsies, oh well, better luck next time. Which is, I think, an important part of the story of what the Cyber 9/11 will look like. The idea that these incredibly sophisticated cyber weapons are being developed, absolutely being developed, by the US, by Israel, by every major government on Earth, I'm sure. And it's a question of, well, can they be contained, and do they necessarily want them to be contained? Another extremely important example from very recently, people will remember the WannaCry ransomware attack, where this ransomware was infecting people's computers, and it's locking them down, we need Bitcoin to unseal them. Well, as even Microsoft pointed out at the time, and let alone many other researchers, the malware that underlied the WannaCry attack was itself a vulnerability that was discovered by, and hoarded by the NSA. Back in 2016, Bruce Schneier and other online security experts were talking about how these latest WikiLeaks revelations and other things are pointing to the fact the NSA, they've told us they're not hoarding vulnerabilities. They're not finding these software backdoors and abilities to hack this software. They're not taking that and hoarding it in some treasure chest somewhere so they can use it for themselves. But they are. And the Shadow Brokers story and other things like that admitted it. Well, as it turns out, yes, not only are they finding these exploits and these vulnerabilities in the software and hoarding them for themselves, not telling the software vendors about these exploits so that they can actually fix the problem, well, now those exploits are getting out to the public, and they are being used by criminals or whoever is doing things like the WannaCry attack. So it's already happening, that this proliferation of cyber weaponry is happening, and all it takes from there is for something to get out there into the wrong hands and then be used in an attack, and everyone can go, oh, look, this is horrible. We need more power. We need more money. We need bigger budgets in order to combat this problem, which is exactly why there's a renewed push. There's already a U.S. Cyber Command, but now they want to make it a separate military branch, its own agency, really, or branch of the military, to take it out from under the wing of the NSA, where it is currently, and to make it into a full-fledged command. And why is there the push behind this? It's because every week there's a new story of hacking or what have you, a lot of it being enabled by these vulnerabilities that are found by and exploited by the intelligence agencies, and then, oops, wouldn't you know it, somehow or other get out into the wild. So I think there's a lot of different moving parts to this puzzle, but the main part to keep in mind is that, of course, it is the intelligence agencies and the militaries of all of the major governments that are behind the most spectacular of these weapons that are likely to be used in whatever kind of cyber 9/11 we're going to see down the road.
Well, just like we see these attacks, like the ransomware attack, coming essentially from, when you trace it back far enough, the NSA, the American government, we can also, you know, make the point that it's the American government who's really pushing this Russian hacking meme right now. So it seems to me that in the minds of the masses, should a cyber attack take place, right away they're going to be thinking that Russia is likely the ones who are responsible, and that's possibly by design. So what do you make of, you know, the lead up to this cyber attack and the current Russian hacking meme that is going around based on absolutely zero evidence?
Yes, well, I mean, it is a meme. I think that's the right way to think of it. It is simply an idea that has been placed in the public consciousness, as you say, without any evidence to back it up. And it's even more insidious than that. You can take a look, for example, last month when the Reality Winner story came out and was briefly reported on. It was, oh my God, guys, look, the Russian election hacking was much more pervasive than we thought. And these internal NSA documents show that, in fact, they were worried that that all of these different election servers and databases were being hacked by those dastardly Russians. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. Number one, which is the main problem with this entire arena, is the attribution problem. How do you know where these attacks are coming from? That is a much, much more important and deeper and more difficult to answer question than is ever let on in the mainstream discourse. But secondarily, with this story in particular, you'll see, for example, Time.com had this story up on June 22nd. Election hackers altered voter rolls, stole private data, officials say. Or Bloomberg had a story up, Russian cyber hacks on U.S. electoral system far wider than previously known. Which, of course, people generally read the headlines, maybe read the first paragraph or two to get the gist of a story. That's the most more, that's kind of all the information they consume on it. But you have to dig deep, 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 deep down into the story to find out that, in fact, there is no evidence that they were able, the Russian hackers, or whoever actually did it, were able to affect the counting within the machine. So they didn't actually change anything that was going on in the count, in the vote. They didn't actually affect the vote that way. But they were saying, but the effect on the election is a different matter, because somehow the Russians were hacking into people's minds and making them vote for Trump, I guess. This is the level at which this Russian hacking story has been taking place. The idea, the words Russian hackers has been used a million times, but not one person in a thousand can actually articulate what the exact thing that these hackers were supposed to have done is. There are a number of different pieces here, and they're all just kind of grouped under this umbrella, and it's Russian hackers, and they stole the election. But how do you get from A to Z there? What is the actual mechanism? We know, for example, that John Podesta was spearfished, which is, so somebody sent him an email saying, hey, John, your Google, somebody's trying to sign into your Google email account. You better give us your password and we'll check it out for you, or whatever ridiculous nonsense email. And he apparently conferred with his IT official to say, hey, is this real? And the IT official said something back. I don't remember the exact exchange, but he meant to say, yeah, don't give them your password. We'll check into it. But it came out sounding like, yeah, it's real. So John Podesta put in his email password and they stole it and got his emails. At least that's the story we're being told, and how do we know from the outside? Because we're not privy to any of that information, but that's the official story anyway. And because that type of attack, sending someone an email saying, hey, give us your password, has been associated with groups that in the past have been associated with the Russian government, well, then clearly it was the Russian government doing it. I mean, you can see there are multiple layers of attribution problems there. Well, how do you know that it was this group that sent that email? And then how do you know that that group is connected to the Russian government? There are definitely multiple layers to go through there. And again, it's not an easy stepping stone from A to Z. That's one of them. Then there's the DNC emails and the DNC hack, which, again, hack is a supposition, because for all we know, it could have been a leak. So, and there are multiple people who say that there was leak, and there's the whole Seth Rich story and all of that. So was the DNC hacked at all, or was it leaked information from the inside? Very good reasons to believe it was leaked and not hacked. And then there's the voting machines and how they were hacked. But as they admit, they didn't actually change any of the vote counts. So what is this Russian election hacking? What does it mean? What is even behind it? Even if we can just unblindly and unquestioningly assume that they are right in attributing all of these different things to Russian hackers, which we cannot because there is really no good attribution. But even if we could take that at face value, what does it mean? What did they hack? What did they change? And this is the fundamental problem here. But it's a very, very, very effective two-word phrase, isn't it? Russian hackers, Russian hackers, Russian hackers. And we've seen that a million times in the past year. That is preparing the public consciousness so that when something spectacular and undeniable happens, you know, people lose Facebook for a week or whatever it is, you know, oh my God, the world's coming to an end. Russian hackers, that idea is already there, and it just has to be invoked. No evidence necessary, no evidence required, no evidence probably even possible when you really get to it, because unless you physically have the server logs, you have to take everyone's word for it. And even if you have the server logs, there are multiple ways for people to cloak, mask, and otherwise hide their identity online, or hide behind proxies, or make it look like an attack is coming from somewhere else. So it's just a complete mess. But that Russian hacker meme has been effectively planted in the public consciousness.
Well, the one thing that boggles my mind about it the most is, as far as the public is concerned, okay, let's assume that your delusion is correct and the Russians did hack the election here. Well, what are you saying then? That the Russians hacked the DNC, the emails, to prove that the DNC hacked the election? I mean, they haven't really given this a lot of thought. So basically, they're just propagandized into just blindly accepting this Russian hacking meme, as you say, to precondition them for a potential upcoming attack.
Right, and let's just reiterate that for the people who didn't get it. Yeah, the official story here seems to be that the Russians rigged the election by showing how the DNC rigged the election, by exposing those emails. I mean, it's preposterous on its face. But clearly, this is not in the realm of rationality. This is in the realm of politics and party lines. And I'm a Democrat, so I must go along with this narrative, so people invest their entire identity in it. That's very dangerous. And it leads to the even more bizarre state of affairs that we're in right now, where the left side of the left-right PSYOP now has invested their identity and so much in the intelligence agencies. Now it's, oh, the CIA said it, the NSA said it, the FBI said it. It's gospel truth. We must believe it. What a bizarre state of affairs. I mean, look, the left and right are just two sides of the same bird of prey, but if there was any sort of general association you would have had in previous decades, it's that the people on the left could see through and knew that the intelligence agencies were lying liars that told nothing but lies. But now, well, they're telling the types of lies we like, so yes, we must believe everything they say. It's such a bizarre state of affairs.
Well, James, what do you think the end game is here, especially in regards to a potential cyber attack? Is it about, you know, bringing about Internet 2.0 and getting more control over the free flow of information? I think, you know, a lot of people are talking about cryptocurrencies and the fact that a lot of people are holding these cryptocurrencies outside of the government's control. Is this essentially maybe a kill switch to be able to destroy the cryptos or essentially bring in Internet 2.0? What in your analysis is the end game here?
There are so many potential ways that this could play out that, of course, it depends on what specific way it happens. But I think, as you say, we can already see some of the pieces lining up, one of which does have to do with cryptocurrencies, which have already been thoroughly demonized in the minds of the public through WannaCry ransomware attacks and other things like that, that most people know of Bitcoin now because, oh, that's that untraceable currency that the criminals want you to pay in. It's a criminal currency, is the way that it's been linked in people's mind, which is, again, I mean, it's so absurd on so many different levels. It's like, oh, in any other time in human history, those people that were asking for ransom were asking for it in dollars or euros or yen or whatever. So therefore, the dollar is a criminal currency. Yeah, I mean, it's just so stupid, but people kind of throw that out the window because this is something new, so the only way we can be introduced to it is in that context. So I think to a certain extent, maybe it's already mission accomplished with linking the idea of crypto with criminal, so that I don't think the end game is to destroy the cryptos. We already see major investment in blockchain technology from all of the, you know, the banking sector and all the usual criminal suspects, but they just want to use it, I think, for their own purposes and create private and controlled blockchains, not a truly distributed ledger like Bitcoin that is completely open and not governable, but something that is controlled, and they'll have a million ways to do that. And of course, the pressure is already on to make every single exchange, crypto exchange in the world, require, you know, 15 pieces of ID before they do any business with anyone. So I think we're already on the path to that, but that could be one element of a cyber attack. Another element would be demonizing a political enemy. And although in the lead up to this, in the last decade or two, I would say that all of the preparatory work on that front has been towards the Chinese government, China hackers, China cyber attacks, China's espionage, China cyber warfare. That is obviously, as we say, has flipped in the past year, and now it's all Russian hacking. There's even cyber North Korean cyber warfare that meme has been steadily maintained over the years, so they could bring that out if they wanted to. There's a lot of different ways they could go with it. But the question, if the question is what is the ultimate end goal of a cyber 9/11, we don't have to look further than what's already admitted on the record by Lawrence Lessig, who's a Harvard professor, has some notoriety. He ran for U.S. president in 2016, didn't get very far, but at any rate, he's a noted figure. And in 2008, he was at a technology conference in Half Moon Bay, California, when he revealed on stage that he had been talking to Richard Clark, obviously the former national counterterrorism czar under Clinton and then Bush, during 9/11 as well, of course. And he said, quote, "There is going to be an I-9/11 event, which doesn't necessarily mean an Al-Qaeda attack. It means an event where the instability or the insecurity of the internet becomes manifest during a malicious event, which then inspires the government into a response. You've got to remember that after 9/11, the government drew up the Patriot Act within 20 days, and it was passed." Sidebar, that's not true. The Patriot Act was drawn up for years beforehand, and Joe Biden brags about being part of that process, I think 6 years before the Patriot Act was actually passed, back in 95 in the wake of the OKC bombing. But anyway, and then Lessig continued, "So I was having dinner with Richard Clark, and I asked him if there is an equivalent, if there is an I-Patriot Act just sitting waiting for some substantial event as an excuse to radically change the way the internet works. He said, of course there is," end quote. So that is openly admitted. We know there is an I-Patriot Act that is sitting there waiting for a cybernet 9/11 to justify tabling it and passing it in 20 days when the hysteria is still going on. And we can imagine the types of things that will be included in there, one of which will be the utter destruction of any degree of potential of anonymity or even pseudonymity on the internet. We've heard about a license to get on the internet or fingerprinting to get on the internet. These ideas have been floated. They've even been experimented with by the U.S. government. Some of its agencies have used some forms of ID, including fingerprinting, as test examples of how they can get their employees to sign on to their systems and things like this. So this is the technology obviously is already there. It's just waiting for the excuse to implement something like that. And if people really want to know where this is heading, some of the creepiest information I've seen in the past 24 hours on this front has come from the official Chinese state government mouthpiece media, where People's Daily China just had a post up bragging that China has shut down 3,918 illegal websites in the second quarter. And you might be tempted to think, well, illegal, what does that mean? They've got whatever, child pornography, or they're selling, you know, nuclear weapons or something. No, these illegal websites include anything that that the government doesn't officially allow to be posted. And in fact, the Chinese government is going through a crackdown on online media right now. Of course, they've always had something of a crackdown, but it's getting much more severe. And GlobalTimes.cn is bragging that China's online media purification drive is changing millennials' lifestyles, talking about how the government has been cracking down on video sharing sites where people were sharing Japanese anime or foreign television programs and things like that. They've completely eliminated that, and now only government-approved material will be allowed to be shared online. Surprise, surprise. That is where this is ultimately heading. The kind of clampdown that, again, from our perspective right now, it sounds like, oh, that's crazy, that couldn't happen, in the exact same way that if you went up to an American in the 1990s and told them about the Department of Homeland Security and TSA and all of this craziness, they would have went, that's crazy, that could never happen here. Well, again, we know it is waiting in the wings, and they're just waiting for the Cyber 9/11 to bring it about.
Well, I guess the question now is, you know, having said all that, what do people do to be able to protect themselves? I mean, is there a way to, you know, encrypt our info or do things online to protect ourselves? Or are we beyond that? Are we up to the point now where you just need to, you know, stockpile your own food, load up on some guns, and have yourself a bunker in your backyard? You know, what do you think are the solutions at this point?
Well, I don't want to be airy-fairy about it, because at this point, it is almost, I mean, almost impossible for people to be not involved in these types of systems in any way, that they don't have a bank account, they don't shop in any way online, they don't have any sort of tie to anything that happens online, their job doesn't depend on online access. I mean, it's almost impossible not to be immersed in this in some form at this point, or for it not to affect your livelihood or your life in some degree of detail. There are, I think, things that we should be concentrating on right now when we do have this relative breathing space before whatever's coming comes, and that is in the absolute need to decentralize the internet. That sounds almost like an oxymoron of some sort, because of course the internet is decentralized. That's the point of the internet. That's why it was created, is so that there's no central node. But it's interesting, on the World Wide Web, people have voluntarily started to all congregate in the same spots, and they're all putting all their data and spending all their time online in the same few very centralized controlled spots. Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, eBay. We know where the major sites are and where people spend almost all of their time online. And it's all voluntarily done. I mean, there's no one with a gun pointed at your head saying you must use Twitter, you must use Facebook, you must use YouTube. It's happening because that's where everyone is. So that's where you go and that's where you congregate. There are alternatives to those highly centralized places that are available now. I know you know about Steemit. I don't know if the audience knows about Steemit, but that's one example. There's yours.com, there's minds.com, there's a decentralized YouTube like BitChute right now. I just saw a new one that popped up on Steemit that's going to be distributed through the Steam blockchain. There's lots of innovative things that are going on right now, and I know it's the network effect. People don't want to go on these new alternative platforms because, well, there's nobody there, and that creates the snake eating its tail, and how do you solve that problem? But, again, if we don't start getting off of these very highly centralized and controlled things, then it's going to be so much easier once the Cyber 9/11 happens for these centralized locations to be the place where they can lock you in and say, okay, if you want to use Twitter now, we're going to need your thumbprint and iris scan and your blood sample or whatever it is. And they can do that to the highly controlled and centralized parts of the internet. Much harder to do on the peripheries on peer-to-peer networks and things where people can actually bypass all of those nodes, those central points of control. So I think that's where some part of this solution lies. And again, we are so heavily immersed and embedded in this that I don't think it's going to be a perfect solution. The other part of this that I think is extremely important is that being aware of and spreading awareness of the cyber false flag meme before the major cyber false flag event happens is exceptionally important, in the exact same way that if there had been the type of consciousness of false flag terrorism back in 2001 that we have now, 9/11 would have been much harder to pull off. I don't mean technically speaking, but in terms of, okay, everyone, here's the boogeyman, let's go after him, yay, now justify everything that we're going to do for the next two decades. There would be a significantly larger percentage of the public that would step back and say, well, how do we know this? Where's the proof? If it were to happen in today's climate. And I think similarly, we have to prepare the public to be skeptical of the cyber 9/11. Let's be clear about what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that there aren't Russian hackers, Chinese hackers, North Korean hackers, American hackers, British hackers, Canadian hackers, Israeli hackers. Absolutely every country has its hackers that are, I have no doubt, probing and testing and trying to hack into systems all the time, all around the world. It could even be a real event that is allowed to happen or just takes place and they piggyback on it. But the ultimate point of this is we have to be aware of who is going to step in the wake of any spectacular attack and claim to be the saviors and herd everyone into this solution or that solution or impose this draconian new legislation. And I think the more the public is ready and primed and aware of that, the more it's like a magic trick. You show the audience that he's got the cards up his sleeve, and it ruins the magic trick. And I think that's an important part of this, which is why I hope people will spread information about programs like this one.
Absolutely. I think awareness is essential. Awareness is absolutely key. I would agree with you there. That's why I think people should share this video right now. Spread this information. Share it with your friends and family. Use their tools like Facebook and Twitter to get this information out there so that people can at least be aware that this is happening in the first place before they get sideswiped with this cyber attack seemingly coming out of nowhere. And I would encourage people to share James Corbett's work as well. James, I'm sure you're going to be covering this more so as it continues to develop. So give us the links for people who want to be able to share the information from your websites as well.
Well, CorbettReport.com is the one-stop shop for all of my information. That's CorbettReport.com. And specifically on this, if you go to the newsletter section, you'll find a newsletter that I've recently done on bracing for cyber 9/11, which is obviously relevant to today's conversation. It has lots of links to a lot of the things that I'm talking about here today and more kind of background context of where this is coming from. And just type cyber into my search bar and you'll find lots of things that I've done on this in the past, or virtual false flag. I've talked about that before. It's a thing. It's real. It's coming. And I think we have to be ready and prepared for it.
Fantastic. All right. We're going to have all of those links in the description located below. Folks, check them out. Be sure to share them with your friends and family and share this video as well. James, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on.